Hello, folks. Trust everybody is well. We have a very interesting topic today. I'm joined by Alex, so he and I, sometimes when we get talking, we can get into the nitty-gritty details. So we're going to try to avoid it so we can get all we have to get in this hour. Our topic today is Human Rights Law at Work, a Primer and Emerging Issues. And I think by the end of our agenda today, you will recognize that employers are indeed dealing with emerging issues, need to be aware of these emerging issues to ensure that steps that you do take or steps that you failed to take that will not result in any kind of exposure or liability for you. So by way of agenda, to dig right into it, I suppose I should get through the cosmetics or the housekeeping matters first. Remind those of you who are attending the live webinar that we encourage you to ask questions via the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen, as we are unable to use the raise hand function. We'll make our best efforts to answer questions which are asked in the currency of the presentation. If, however, we are unable to answer your question, as always, an E2R team member will be in touch shortly to set up a time for you to speak with an advisor. We remind all listeners that all of our previous topics can be heard directly by visiting our online resource center at e2rsolutions.com. And lastly, we would remind you that the information that we are providing you today is intended as a general analysis and not a specific legal analysis of your particular situation. For that, we would certainly request that you contact us so that we can discuss your specific situation. Our next e-learning with E2R will take place on November 30th, which is close to the holidays. And in light of that, our topic will be essential tasks closing out 2016 and starting 2017, that's right, 2017, off right. So, in light of our robust agenda, let's get started and take a look at what we're going to deal with today. The scope of human rights legislation, by way of general overview, so we all appreciate and understand the framework that governs what we're looking at today. We will then consider human rights commissions and tribunals and arbitrations in Canada. In other words, how are complaints from a procedural standpoint, how are they handled in Canada? We will then focus on family status and gender identity expression. Although family status has been around for some time in the human rights legislation throughout Canada, it has taken on a much broader and significant impact now for employers. Gender identity expression is essentially new to human rights legislation and not yet throughout Canada. So we will talk about that and some of the implications of that new prohibited ground. We will then touch on what is a new area, and there's legislation that we will speak to that relates to genetic testing. And can employers rely on the information that arises from that testing to, in fact, make certain decisions? We will move to how to protect your organization from human rights complaints, which is, of course, a significant interest that you have for obvious reasons. We will discuss immediately before the conclusion, the duty to accommodate in the employment context, and that, of course, is a very significant area. We will only have so much time to touch on, but, of course, a fundamental part of human rights legislation and employer compliance requirements. And then, of course, we will move to conclusion and give you some of our parting comments. All right, by way of sort of introduction, to the human rights regime, we will first discuss the areas of protection. So given we provide advice to you on an ongoing basis in the area of employment, sometimes we forget that human rights legislation doesn't just protect individuals from discrimination on the basis of prohibited grounds in the employment space only. It also deals with, as you see in the slide before you, not only employment, but services and facilities, living accommodation and tenancy, contracts and commercial arrangements, together with membership in vocational associations and trade unions. So in these areas, there can also be claims by individuals, for example, in their accommodation or in access to services, where they can say, hey, somehow I believe that in my access to this particular service, I was denied on the basis of a prohibited ground of discrimination. So the human rights codes not only deal with employment, but they also deal with these other areas as well.
And I guess the first kind of starting point you're going to need to be aware of is, what are the prohibited grounds of discrimination? What am I or am I not allowed to make an employment decision in this case based upon? And so those are going to vary by jurisdiction, and that's going to be set out in each of the Human Rights Code or Human Rights Act in the province or at the federal level. But there are some grounds that are common amongst all jurisdictions, and we've listed them here on the slide. They are age. There are disability, which does include either drug or alcohol dependency, so there is a duty to accommodate on that ground under the disability heading. Marital and family status, and we'll delve deep into family status during today's presentation. Race or color, another one is religion. A very common one and expansive one is sex, and that differs from gender and gender identity, which we will also be speaking about in detail today. But sex does include both pregnancy and childbirth, and the obligations that arise therefrom. Sometimes there's some overlapping issues related to the ground of disability related to pregnancy. And I guess lastly, across all jurisdictions, is sexual orientation. Now, there's really two primarily types of discrimination. There is direct discrimination, which is generally open, overt, and typically intentional. And then there's indirect discrimination, where there's a seemingly neutral rule or policy or practice on its face that doesn't appear to be discriminatory one way or another, but that does have an effect on excluding or putting an individual at a disadvantage based upon that prohibited ground of discrimination. So, for example, direct discrimination would be someone who, during the interview process, I find out that you have a child. I would prefer that my employees don't have children because I know they can work later, they can travel, do all sorts of things that I want my employees to do. If I make a decision based upon that person having a child or not, that would be considered direct discrimination. Now, indirect discrimination is something where there's a work rule. For example, I like my employees to work overtime, and you can't work overtime because you may have child obligations. And so even though the obligation or my requirement for you to work overtime isn't discriminatory on its face, by its practice, it's discriminatory. Now, I need to just quickly note that even though direct discrimination usually involves intention, it's quite possible that you could be discriminating against someone directly without knowing. So not knowing what the prohibited grounds of discrimination are is not a defense to direct discrimination. So, for example, if you didn't know family status was a prohibited ground of discrimination, that doesn't mean that you're not directly discriminating against me by requiring me not to have a child to be in your employ. And I guess lastly, there are some types of positive discrimination or favoritism, as it were, that is permitted under certain very, very narrow exceptions, also known as affirmative action.
So let's say you have an employee, and the employee is of the view that he or she has been discriminated against on the basis of a prohibited ground, right? And we're going to be talking about family status. And so an employee perhaps alleges that he or she has been discriminated on the basis of family status because we have changed an hours of work schedule. So where does that employee go? Where does that employee go to seek redress for what that employee perceives to be a discriminatory act, i.e. in the case I just mentioned, changing my hours of work, but I have childcare responsibilities, so I cannot accede to that changed schedule. All right, so where do I go? Well, it depends where you are in Canada. Right, so we have human rights commissions and tribunals at both the federal and provincial levels. Right, but actually, if you note, as you see in the slide, in Saskatchewan, you actually go to the Court of Queen's Bench to adjudicate claims that relate to human rights. So you go to the court system in Saskatchewan. So how does it work where you have commissions? Well, typically, where you have a commission, the individual, let's use the example of the employee, will complain and file a complaint with the commission. Those commissions will typically then investigate. So you've now filed a claim with an administrative government agency. That agency is now charged with an investigation. For those of you on our call today that are from or have operations in Ontario, Ontario used to have that system, no longer has that system. So the commission then investigates, and what happens when they come to the end of their investigative process? Well, they decide whether the matter should be in effect. They don't agree with it, and they say we're going to dismiss it, or they refer it to the tribunal for now a formal hearing. So in effect, you have a vetting process where the commission engages in an investigation and makes a determination as to whether it ought to be referred to the tribunal for, in effect, a trial. Ontario, British Columbia, and Nunavut, however, use direct access models where complainants go right to the tribunal to have their claims adjudicated. Now, Ontario has a commission, they still have a commission, but its use is really more for public advocacy. They can intervene in certain situations, but ultimately that commission from a day-to-day standpoint plays a very minimal role. So what do you have now in these direct access provinces, BC's had it longer than Ontario, is everybody files a complaint. If they have a complaint, it's not vetted anymore. There's no vetting. It goes right into a trial process. So for those who argue in support of the vetting process, that's gone in Ontario, BC, and Nunavut. You have an immediate litigation process, which is the cause, understandably so, for many employers, and Ontario employers have recently had to undergo this change, a frustration. Because you will even have the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal in their own informal statistics acknowledge that a large percentage of claims are simply vexatious and without merit. But because it goes through a litigation stream right away, you're stuck with it. You're stuck with it. And hopefully at the mediation stage, if the applicant has elected to proceed by way of mediation, it can be resolved at that time. If it isn't, off you go to what may be a 3, 4, 5, 6 day trial at the Human Rights Tribunal. That employee pays for nothing. Nothing to have that matter proceed through. The employer, of course, in the vast majority of circumstances, is going to seek representation from outside counsel. Of course, that's costly. So, in terms of that process for filing the actual complaint with the commissions, no fees, right? You're not charged anything. It's quasi-judicial, right? Common for complainants and to be self-represented. Now, this is a tremendous cause for concern in Ontario, BC, and Nunavut, because you have self-represented people that are going through the process, and it's extremely difficult to deal with self-represented litigants, as it were, who have no concept of what this area and the legal sort of legal principles that apply. All right? So in terms of cost effectiveness, right, it's very cost effective for an employee complainant because they're not paying for anything, right? It's just their time. But of course, the employer invariably will want outside representation, and that's costly. And by the way, employer, if you win, basically what you get at the end of that, if you're all listening carefully, see if you can guess what this sounds like. That's applause. Because as an employer, you simply, if you're victorious, you get no costs. So you've incurred all these costs, and you get a decision that says at the end of the day, oh, employer didn't discriminate, perhaps some applause, that's where it ends.
Now let's look at what happens if we are found to have breached the Human Rights Code or Human Rights Act in whatever province we are dealing with. There are various remedies available to either the commissions or the tribunals or the courts in some cases related to breaches of the legislation. And these powers do vary widely. So the first one is obviously compensation for loss, wages, benefits, and expenses. That's pretty self-explanatory, as is an order from the tribunal to either cease the offending conduct. So for example, if there is direct discrimination going on, employer, please stop that. And also an order to prevent you from doing it on a go-forward basis. So employer, do not do that on an ongoing or in the future. Now, there's also, and this is the main thrust of the damages, and you'll see this a lot in those letters you get from plaintiff's counsel, alleging damages for injury to dignity, feelings, and self-respect, otherwise known as human rights damages. Now, these have increasingly gone up over the years, and they can range from as little as $5,000 to upwards now to $35,000, $40,000, even $50,000 in certain cases. So that's where you're really going to get whacked if you're breaching someone's human rights. They also have the authority, and you also see this requested a lot as a remedy, for the employer to have workplace training on human rights, as well as implementing policies, which I'm sure you do have if you use our service, but if you don't, and they will order you to have a diversity policy or a medical leave policy or something similar if you are offending those types of ideals. And lastly, and certainly not leastly, is their power is open-ended. So they can order even reinstatement in certain cases. And the one case that comes to mind was a recent case where an employee, for one reason or another, didn't have their matter heard for 10 years. It got lost in the shuffle, and the tribunal thought it was warranted to reinstate that employee to their job 10 years later with full back pay. That's a worst-case scenario, but it does highlight the degree of power that these tribunals have in ordering remedies. Now, that refers to remedies in the non-unionized context, and I'll let Stuart kind of expand on what might happen in a unionized workplace.
And just before we get to that, Alex raises a great point. I don't know, and Alex, you can tell me if you've seen anything different, but what we typically see now, anytime you have a former employee who retains outside counsel and alleges, you know, my severance compensation is inadequate, there's no counsel not worth his or her salt that's not going to try to probe his or her client, former employee, whether there's some claim of discrimination. And if there is, then you get to threaten reinstatement, right, as part of it. And now in Ontario, the courts can order reinstatement. Well, theoretically, they can order reinstatement because they can now adjudicate breaches of the Human Rights Code where formerly they couldn't. So, Alex, I take it you see that as well, right?
Yeah, I do see that as well, and you'll often see in the demand asking for a lump sum kind of damage payment on account of this kind of breach or alleged breach. And I recently got a letter actually where they allude to breaches of the Human Rights Code but don't specifically ask for money, so kind of essentially alluding to the fact that we're being nice guys here, and if you don't give us this great severance package we're asking for, then the next ask is definitely going to be a large lump sum payment. So it is typical, and it's something that we have to deal with, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's funny as well. You also, if what a what counsel will do is they'll threaten the notion that their client will proceed to a human rights commission or tribunal, depending on the jurisdiction. The messaging being to the employer and employer's counsel is that, hey, my client's not going to have to pay for anything. You guys are going to pay a ton to try to defend this human rights complaint. Surely it's in your business interest, employer, to pay up now as opposed to going through a lengthy process where you'll be paying through the nose. So the human rights leverage component is real in today's world. And so as a result, you have to be, once again, extremely mindful of it and try to be as proactive as you can be. So in the unionized context, what's typically going to happen is a collective agreement will incorporate a grievance and arbitration procedure, typically a pretty quick procedure for the most part. And so unionized employees, where they have claims of discrimination on the basis of prohibited ground discrimination, will invariably go before an arbitration board, which is appointed under the collective agreement as a result of the inability to resolve the matter through the grievance procedure. So what do you end up with? An arbitrator who has the same powers as any human rights tribunal in the unionized context to make any order that the arbitrator deems fit. And because it's the unionized environment, you will often see where a discharge involved a reinstatement where the discharge was based in whole or in part on a prohibited ground of discrimination.
So let's talk about one of the emerging topics, and this has been an emerging topic for the past few years, given that the case law in this area has evolved from being discriminated against on the basis of your relationship with another person in your family to now child care and elder care obligations, which we'll get into in a minute. And now each piece of legislation defines family status differently. So for in Ontario, under the Human Rights Code, it defines family status as a status of being in a parent and child relationship. And we'll get to what the courts have kind of elaborated from that definition, which has gone a lot further than just being in a relationship, in a parent-child relationship at that. Under the Alberta Human Rights Act, it defines family status a bit more broadly, which is the status of being related to another person by blood, marriage, or adoption. And like I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court of Canada originally looked at this as you cannot be discriminated on the basis of you being in a relationship with a family member. So typically, if I have Stuart and I have Leora, my employee, and they are brother and sister, or they are parent, child, if I terminate Stuart, I cannot then terminate Leora based upon the fact that she is Stuart's daughter. That's a direct family status discrimination. That is what would have meant by status of being in a parent and child relationship. Now, unfortunately for us, that concept, as defined in these various pieces of legislation, has expanded considerably. And now we're looking at employers having to accommodate family obligations that may conflict with workplace obligations. And it's expanded to both child care obligations and elder care obligations.
So as, you know, as Alex identifies, you know, it's funny, the movement in the definition of family status. At one time, it was perceived to be your status. So in other words, if somebody is hired, right, and they're married, let's say they're married and you're hiring that person versus somebody who's single, right, and you decide on the basis of that status whether you're going to hire them or not, right? So if you think somebody who's married, right, is, or let's use it because it's parent-child, I guess. I'm looking at the marital status, which would be the same interpretation. But if somebody, as Alex said before, in a parent-child relationship and you're saying, well, you're, because of that status, we're not going to hire you, well, that was clearly an issue, right? And then it moved into, right, who you're married to. So if I'm married to my spouse and we both work for the company and my spouse has been terminated for fraud and then I get terminated, well, that's now expanded to cover the identity of the person, right, in terms of who they are. And now what we're looking at is we're going well beyond, and we're now looking at, right now, accommodating on the basis of, right, the person's elder care or child care arrangements. So let's take a look at what happened with in the Campbell River scenario. So what you have in that fact scenario is you have basically a change of hours of work, and then the employee says, hey, I can't deal with that change in the hours of work because I have a child at home that has a disability and I have to cater to that disability. So in looking at the principles that applied, this case said what's called a prima facie case of discrimination. So how is it made out? You first have to establish that there's discrimination to get any kind of remedy from a tribunal. Well, it's made out when a change in a term or condition of employment imposed by an employer results in a serious interference with a substantial parental or family duty or obligation. All right, so let's work that backwards. What does it mean? Well, there's got to be a change by the employer in a term or condition of employment, and it has to result in a serious interference with a substantial parental or family duty. All right, so look at these significant requirements that are placed on the ability of a complainant to say, I have a basic case of discrimination, and now I'm asking the employer to accommodate me. Right? So, as you see in the next point, decisions that followed from this Campbell River case said, hey, that seems a little too stringent. Right? They should be analyzed in the same way as other discrimination claims. Right? In other words, did the decision of the employer, something the employer did it result in some kind of adverse treatment to me based on family status? And so this notion that says, hey, the Campbell River is too stringent, it's being treated differently than other prohibited grounds, led to what Alex is going to now discuss, the Johnstone decision, which became the sort of significant decision in this area.
Yes, and we've discussed Johnstone and various pieces of correspondence to our clients and also in prior e-learning sessions. But essentially, Johnstone has opened the door to family status issues. And in particular, in Johnstone, we had an individual who had a couple of children and was no longer able to work her rotating shift schedule. She requested certain accommodations to that schedule. Ultimately, her employer refused those accommodations after trying some things out and then refused, and then Johnstone brought a complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal at the federal level. It went all the way up to the Federal Court of Appeal, ultimately, which found that, in fact, the employer had a duty to accommodate, to change Ms. Johnstone's schedule to accommodate her child care needs. Now, what's significant here is that they, once again, said the Campbell River test was too stringent. And so, as Stuart mentioned, under Campbell River, you needed to prove that there was a change in a term and a serious interference with a substantive parental right. Now, in this case, the employer didn't change a thing. Ms. Johnstone knew what her schedule was before she gave birth, and then after she gave birth, that existing schedule no longer fit her familial needs. So no longer were you required under Johnstone to say that the employer changed something. So, for example, you could hire someone that works for you for the first week that says, no problem, I can work 9 to 5. And then week 2 says, you know what, actually, I can't work 9 to 5. I need family status accommodation to leave at 4 o'clock to pick up my child from school. And we'll get to how that looks like later. But that change aspect was off the table with Johnstone. And so what the court in Johnstone said was there's a test specifically for child care obligations, and this is the four-part test. One, that there is a child under the employee's care. Secondly, that the child care obligation issue engages that individual's legal responsibility. So it's not a choice of theirs. It's a legal responsibility. For example, I am legally responsible for this child. There's no one else that can watch this child. I must watch this child. It is not still, thankfully, my child has a soccer game. I want to go watch that soccer game. Therefore, you need to let me leave early to watch that soccer game. Thirdly, that he or she has made efforts to meet those obligations on their own. So if we're talking about child care obligations, that I've explored and exhausted daycare options, other family members to look after that child, or what have you. That was a key point that kind of worked in the employer's favor. That first response when an employee asked for accommodation was, well, what have you done to explore what you can do first before we decide to change workplace schedules around? And lastly, the workplace rule must interfere with them more than on a trivial basis. Now, obviously, the employer, like any ground of discrimination, is permitted to assert a defense, and that defense is known as a bona fide occupational requirement, meaning it's an essential part of that job that X happens. So, for example, if I work in a factory and my schedule is 8 to 4 and I'm in charge of running that machine and there's no one else that can run that machine, there's no alternating schedules, there's no coverage or anything like that, ultimately you might be able to say it's a bona fide occupational requirement that Stuart's sitting there punching that button from 8 to 4 or bad stuff happens. Or likewise, in a disability context, being unable to do your essential duties could be a bona fide occupational requirement.
So, Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall the facts of this case, doesn't Ms. Johnstone, who works for Canada Border Services Agency, she moves knowingly to a small town well north of Pearson International Airport where she knew the facilities for child care would be far more limited than in the metropolitan Toronto area, and then relies on that limited availability of child care facilities to say, hey, I've got to do all these things now, knowing full well, or in other words, I can't do what the scheduling I did before because I have to now attend to my child care arrangements, which are so much more limited in this area where I voluntarily moved to.
Yeah, I think that was the case. And also, I think if I recall correctly, that her husband also worked for Canada Border Services Agency, and he was not requesting any accommodation, which may have made it easier to accommodate them both slightly as opposed to Ms. Johnstone's schedule fully. And so it's essentially like a disability. You have to take them like you find them. And realistically, now we're going to be talking about a situation after Stuart's done, where we've gone even further on the issue of kind of making your own bed and lying in it. So I'll let Stuart talk about some decisions post-Johnstone, and then we'll get to the real reason why this has come back around, and it's not looking good.
So we saw, and I know it's tough to digest the test, the legal test, but one of the themes that we're suggesting to you, and it will sort of, at least from an Ontario context, end up with a decision that Alex is going to talk about that has really made the test very easy for a complainant to satisfy now. And so as we move along that continuum following Johnstone, right, which also moved along the continuum, we look at this Devaney and ZRV Holdings decision. And what's going on here? We've got an architect who's a long service guy with ZRV. And Mr. Devaney, right, has worked in the office and has worked remotely. But as a result of his elder care requirements, he says, I'm not coming in anymore, basically. I want to keep my mother at home. I don't want to put my mother in a home. So I'm not coming in. I'm going to work remotely. I think it works. Well, the employer says, look, I know you think it works, but there are a lot of morale issues. Your team is suffering significantly because of your failure to attend at work. This has to end. This has to end. And he says, basically, no, I'm not going to do it. My mother needs me, and I want to be there for her. And what's interesting is right at the end, essentially, He tells the employer, it looks like now she's going to move into a home, but by then the employer essentially had made its decision that it was going to terminate. So they terminate. They actually fire for cause. It was found not to be cause, but he brings the human rights complaint as well. And this is in the courts, right, in Ontario. Right? So the tribunal said, what does Johnstone have to show? A different test from Johnstone. What does Mr. Devaney, in effect, have to show? Well, the applicant must establish that his employer's attendance requirement had an adverse impact. That's all. An adverse impact on the applicant because of absences that were required as a result of his responsibilities as his mother's primary caregiver. In other words, by telling you, Mr. Devaney, to come to work, does that have an adverse impact on your responsibilities as the primary caregiver for your mother? That's it. That establishes a prima facie, what's called a prima facie case. Now the onus shifts to the employer to demonstrate that it was a bona fide occupational requirement, the requirement to attend, and that he can't be accommodated up to undue hardship. So it's a very, very tough test that the employer has to meet. Even though the employer could demonstrate very poor morale, wasn't enough to satisfy the test that an employer has to meet to succeed. So let's move to the next case, Partridge and Botany Dental. So you've got an office manager following the maternity leave, right, is told by the employer, sort of almost as an aside at a certain level, well, you're not going to be the office manager anymore. You have to go back to what you were doing before as a dental hygienist, right, and start most work days at 9 a.m., right? But the employee insisted, hey, I'm supposed to be the office manager. I want to be the office manager, right? And she was supposed to start at a different time slot because the employer knew she could not commence work at 9 a.m. That was it, due to the child care arrangements. So she had child care arrangements, couldn't start at 9 a.m. as a dental hygienist because of her child care arrangements. The employer said, well, if you can't start at 9 a.m., then you can't be a dental hygienist. So terminated her employment. So the court looked at that, applied the Johnstone test, and said, wow, change of hours, right? Change in that schedule, it definitely interfered, right? It definitely interfered with her obligations, right? And as a result, and those obligations were more than trivial, there were child care responsibilities, so as a result, there was a finding that indeed it was discrimination on the basis of family status. Other decisions that apply Johnstone. Flat in Canada. Federal Court of Appeal upheld the decision refusing an employee's request to telework full time. Why did she want to telework full time? So she continued to breastfeed her child. But what happens here? The court determines that breastfeeding was a choice, not a legal requirement. Remember when we looked at Johnstone and the test, right? The second test was a child care obligation issue engages the individual's legal responsibility, i.e. not a choice. Well, breastfeeding, you had a choice. So the court said, no, the employer doesn't have to accommodate that. SMS equipment and CEP Local 707, this is in Alberta. The court found an employer's refusal to allow an employee to work straight day shifts as opposed to night shifts to accommodate her child care obligations, by the way, after 7 days of work, was family status discrimination, right? The court determined that the employer couldn't explain why the accommodation could not be made. Remember, the employer's obligation is to demonstrate if the obligation to accommodate is triggered, they have to demonstrate that they can't accommodate up to undue hardship.
Which brings us to the most recent case on this issue rising in Ontario, which came down a few months ago, which has completely turned Johnstone even on its head. So in that case, an employee was proposed a shift change to accommodate a physical restriction that she had, but unfortunately the employer's offer of accommodation for her physical restriction in terms of the hours of work interfered with her elder care responsibilities, specifically that the employee needed to be at home to cook food for her elderly mother. So we had an employer going above and beyond to accommodate a physical restriction and then being told, can't do that accommodation because that interferes with another ground of discrimination, family status, and I need to be home to prepare dinner for my mother. The employee brings a human rights complaint to the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal. The tribunal reviews Johnstone in depth and rules that there shouldn't be a different test for family status discrimination, and they rejected all the rulings related to these different tests for establishing family status. In doing so, they pointed out two very important things, and I'll emphasize these again later. But the first one, and forgive the legal wordiness of it, and I'll explain what it means after, one, that an applicant need not establish that they could not self-accommodate in order to prove discrimination. So essentially, there was no obligation on the employee to see if they could solve their workplace, homeplace conflict themselves before asking the employer to solve their problem for them. So for example, I didn't have to ask my brother if he can feed my mother instead of myself, or whether my father could feed my mother or what have you. I was no longer obligated now to look and see if I can solve the problem on my own. It's essentially my employer's problem if I choose not to try to solve it myself.
And you know, it's funny, Alex, and so when we talked on this end, as this law was evolving, we actually had put questionnaires together that we would recommend to our clients they ask of an employee who's seeking an accommodation based on, let's use the example of elder care, which is exactly as Alex is stating right now. Do you have family members that can help? Are there facilities? What is your financial status? Can you use your financial status to assist in the elder care circumstance that you face? In other words, this self-help idea, which made sense. You would go to the employee saying, I'm not going to work the hours you want me to work or that I've been scheduled to work, right? And you're looking at the employer going, yeah, but I understand you have a whole network of family, using that example around you, that could help. And that seemed to make a lot of sense to pursue that. But now what's happening with this decision, as Alex is identifying, it would appear that that's no longer available.
Yeah, and just on that point quickly, I know we're kind of running long on the family status stuff. This is real important stuff here. I think we are still permitted to request an employee to look into self-accommodation, but that employee could refuse, arguably, and that wouldn't be held against them necessarily down the road if they bring a complaint against us for not changing their schedule. And the second kind of point referenced by the court was also that it's often difficult to prove a legal obligation to take care of your mother or father versus your child. So that was also came out of that decision. Now, even though the tribunal said there is no different test, they essentially outlined a test. So thanks a lot, tribunal. No test, but there is a test. And this is what the test is, and it's on that slide 18 for you here. It says the employee must establish more than a negative impact on a family need. The negative impact must result in a real disadvantage. So I can't argue, I think it's important to be at my child's soccer game for our relationship. Well, that's not going to qualify, hopefully, as a negative impact on a family need. It's more of no one else can look after my child, or rather, I need to look after my child. I don't know if there's no one else. I haven't explored that. I don't have to, but there has to be a real negative impact. And then also, even though there's no self-accommodation requirement, the court is going to look, or the tribunal in this case, at the contextual nature and give consideration for the supports available. So what we might start having to do is to look ourselves to see if there are other options available to the employee and suggest those options. And then if at that point, if they refuse, then maybe we can use that as a partial defense to not changing their schedules in that respect. And then once the employee shows that there's a negative workplace rule, existing or new now, that impacts their family responsibilities, it's up to the employer now to show either undue hardship or a bona fide occupational requirement, essentially we're going to need to accommodate things up to the point of undue hardship, which is a very high standard, and we'll talk about that briefly near the end of the presentation. But the main takeaway from this case is that the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal, at the very least, has done away with the employee's obligation to first try to self-accommodate. So the employee does not have to try to solve their problem first, or put differently, if they don't try to solve the problem first, they're not barred from bringing a family status, just a family status discrimination claim.
Yeah, and that's really, really significant. So, you know, subject to, you know, some subtle arguments, it would appear that the direction the law is going in this area is simply as Alex identifies, that an employee can say, I need this, typically a scheduling issue due to elder care or child care, and you, employer, will have to accommodate me up to undue hardship. There it is. So think about it in your workplaces. How many employees may come forward with elder care or child care on this issue? It's significant. All right, let's move to gender identity and gender expression. Just to let you know about this, there's not really case law per se that we're going to speak to on this issue. It's new, but if you look at what the terms are that you see now in legislation across Canada or developing across Canada, gender identity. Right? We're talking about prohibited grounds under human rights legislation. So what does that mean? One's internal personal sense of being a man or a woman or a boy or a girl. For transgender people, their birth assigned sex and their own internal sense of gender identity do not match. So your birth assigned sex, whatever you have through birth, it doesn't match what that person feels he or she is. Their identity, how they identify. Gender expression, an external manifestation of one's gender identity. So I, right, identify myself as the other gender, that's not my birth assigned gender, and usually that expression is through some kind of masculine, feminine, or gender variant behavior, typically clothing, hairstyle, voice or body characteristics, right? Typically, transgender people seek to make their gender expression match their gender identity rather than their birth assigned sex. All right, so that's what we're looking at. All right, so, you know, if you look at some of the past case law, you'll see some of these issues kind of devolve into a psychiatric medical diagnosis. Of course, we're moving far away from that. All right, so gender expression as a separate ground from gender identity protect how one informs the world of their gender. So, i.e. by wearing clothing not commonly associated with that gender, or wearing makeup and or jewelry associated with the opposite of one's particular gender. That's now protected, right? So if we look at some general sort of macro numbers, according to a recent survey, 56% of employees in general and 86% of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer, LGBTQ, employees would be more likely to consider working for companies that are LGBTQ friendly. Transgender persons are among the most disadvantaged groups in society and routinely experience discrimination and violence as well in and outside the workplace. According to a 2010 study, 18% of participants had been refused employment because they were transgender, and 20% of respondents had been physically or sexually assaulted. Remember, these are people now that if in the workplace, right, if they experience this kind of discrimination, are going to have a clear path to a claim before Human Rights Tribunal. Seven provinces and one territory now have language expressly protecting the rights of transgendered people, as you see in the list there. BC and the federal government has also recently proposed legislative amendments to add gender identity and or expression into their protected grounds of discrimination. But even those provinces and territories without the specific identification of the protection typically are not going to have difficulty upholding their rights. So, you know, in terms of what we see out there and the wisdom that's being gradually gathered with respect to making workplaces more inclusive for the LGBT community. What we're seeing as solid policy in education is about creating an inclusive and respectful workplace, right? Even support groups and larger organizations, as you see, TELUS recently created a support group for the LGBTQ community, and that's now over 1,100 employees strong. So there are approaches that can underscore the inclusiveness of the organization, right? Of course, gender-inclusive bathrooms, right, has been an issue certainly down in the States. They're not legally required necessarily, but certainly larger institutions are taking steps with a view to creating all-gender washrooms. You're seeing it in school boards, universities, CNE, et cetera. The duty to accommodate, what we've been talking about in part here today, is all about trying to create, in part, that inclusive working environment, right, especially where you're getting specific requests for inclusion and accommodation. All right, you're seeing this. This is also in the news now, and it's certainly controversial, but, you know, we're just touching on it to make you aware of it. Accommodation arguably may extend to how individuals are indeed even addressed, such as whether it's he, right, or she, or some other reference to individuals that don't conform to our understanding, our general understanding. Revisions to policy with respect to appearance, dress code, and uniforms also certainly may be required.
And we'll quickly highlight the one case on this matter. There isn't a lot of case law, as Stuart has mentioned, but we will probably see an increase in that in the coming months and years. But in the Vanderputten case, the facts were as follows, and I'll briefly summarize them quickly for you. There was an employee who was in the process of was transitioning from living as a man to living as a woman and had started the process of a sex assignment surgery. Apparently, the employer in that case decided that they were going to consider the employee a man until it received either medical or legal documentation confirming that she was a woman, including insisting that the employee still use the men's change room with the other men, male employees. Ultimately, the employer terminated the employee because they believed the employee was, A, had a poor attitude and was involved in a lot of workplace conflicts and was insubordinate on occasion. The employee, in turn, alleged discrimination during employment and that her termination related to her being transgender. The tribunal ultimately found that the employee was harassed during employment for being transgendered and that the employer contributed to that poisoned work environment by insisting that the employee be treated as a man until she completed the surgery. So much like Stuart had indicated, one form of accommodation may be to refer to the person as they wish to be referred to as their lived gender, not their birth gender. Now, the tribunal acknowledged that it might not treat them the exact same as people with their birth gender, but in this case, the employer didn't explore other alternatives, which is always what the accommodation process is. Are there other alternatives to make this person feel inclusive? And in this case, they could have explored ensuring the employee had some degree of privacy while using the change room as opposed to forcing her to use the change room with the men. The tribunal also found that the employee's termination related in part to her transgendered nature or her identity, because the conflicts that the employer alleged the employee had engaged in were a direct result of her being harassed by her coworkers, and that harassment was not addressed by the employer. And unfortunately for the employer, they ordered the individual 8 months of lost wages and $22,000 in those kind of general damages or injury to dignity and feelings. And so I suspect we'll see a lot more of that. Now, Stuart's going to quickly talk about the next ground or the next wave, which is genetic information and genetic testing.
Yeah, and this is, technologically, I don't have the background knowledge, but what I do know, what we know on this end, is that it's certainly there. The science has developed to the point where the genetic test will disclose tendencies or likelihood with respect to an employee's health, right? Whether they'll develop likelihood of developing diabetes or some other medical condition that indeed an employer certainly might be interested in having knowledge of. So they're not currently experiencing the medical disability, but they may indeed down the line have a high probability of ultimately contracting that disease. And so an employer, understandably, might consider that information. So the Senate recently passed Bill S-201, which will prohibit anyone from requiring anyone to undergo a genetic test or to disclose the results of a genetic test. They would be amending the Canada Labor Code, the Canadian Human Rights Act, allowing both to prohibit discrimination based on genetic characteristics. Right? And as you can see, the violators of the law would be subject to significant fines, up to $1 million and up to 5 years imprisonment. Canada's behind most Western countries in terms of protecting genetic code testing. 26 countries have policies to protect their citizens against genetic discrimination. At present, access to and use of an individual's genetic information is not currently protected under Canadian legislation. Right, so, you know, at least in theory, as a result, individuals can be treated differently in employment and or insurance or other services on the basis of their genetic code. Right? So, it's, you know, I can't say we see this a lot. That would certainly be an overstatement by a long shot, but it is the technology, in effect, has permitted this opportunity to gain this knowledge. So, of course, if it is passed by the federal government, in all likelihood, you're going to see other provinces following suit.
So ultimately, what we want to know is how do we protect ourselves from these types of complaints? And the first is through these types of learning opportunities, educating ourselves of what the prohibited grounds of discrimination are, where the law is going, and all that sort of stuff. And what needs to be taken away from all this is that you need to think about human rights at all aspects of the employment life cycle. So through recruiting, during employment, and at the termination stage. So we need to be mindful that our recruiting decisions don't involve direct or indirect discrimination, that during the course of employment, employees aren't subject to harassment and or workplace rules that constitute direct and indirect discrimination, and obviously decisions to terminate an employee are not based on a prohibited ground. And now the more you know about each prohibited ground and the duty to accommodate and undue hardship, the better off you're going to be to at least minimize the likelihood of a complaint. And as we mentioned early on, the reason why this topic is so fundamental is that the frequency of these complaints continues to rise. The costs associated with these complaints to the employers is large, to employees it's nothing, and so we need to be mindful that all of our decisions must be made with probably good advice as it relates to whether or not we potentially are violating someone's human rights. And I see Stuart banging his head on the desk knowing that this is something we deal with all the time. Now, quickly, on the duty to accommodate, and we've again done presentations and articles in the past, and we're happy to talk about that in more detail with you at any time, but the duty to accommodate requires an employer to identify and change potentially rules, practices, expectations, or procedures that may have a discriminatory impact. So we talked about the possible schedule changes that may need to be made, if possible, as it relates to family status. Now, the duty to accommodate is not unlimited, and you only need to accommodate to the point of undue hardship, meaning if it's going to bankrupt you, I don't mean to say that facetiously because that's what the test is typically, then you don't need to do it. Or if the employee's job duties are inconsistent and they're talking about the fundamental job duties are inconsistent with the accommodation request, you don't need to do it. But in order to explore that properly, we want to have a discussion because there is both a substantive and procedural aspect to the duty to accommodate and undue hardship. And so it's not mentioned in the slide here, but we also need to go through the process. We can't simply just say we can't accommodate and not explain that to the applicant, or at least explore alternatives as it relates to what that accommodation may look like. And lastly, we should always be looking at, and this speaks to more of the procedural element, always look at all the options before deciding what accommodation we can and cannot do and what the undue hardship standard is. We're going to want to have evidence to show we have undue hardship. So an examination of someone's role, for example, before we make that decision and not just assume or form an uninformed opinion on the matter. We need evidence. We need written evidence. And I'll let Stuart conclude this wonderful topic, as you can tell from the excitement in our voices. But this is a very serious thing. So,
thanks, Alex. So, family status we devoted a long time to because it is the emerging prohibited ground. Gender identity, gender expression, that's also going to develop over time. But remember, with family status, we are talking about elder care. We are talking about child care. Every single employee is going to confront that family circumstance. So that means each and every one of your employees potentially is going to require an accommodation. Think about it. So if that's the case, you have to make absolutely sure you don't engage in any form of communication, any form, that may create an optic that you are discriminating or not prepared to appropriately consider any accommodation that's being requested. So we urge you to speak to us because any step you take that can be perceived by a tribunal as failing to acknowledge your obligation, that ultimately could be fatal to any claim that is advanced or any threatened claim. So with that, we are saying have a great day and thank you for attending. And once again, we will be providing you with our last one of the year e-learning on November the 30th. Essential tasks, closing out 2016 and starting 2017 off right. Thanks.